Chapter 58. Robert. Major Prathachulthorn pored over the readouts that lay like blown leaves spread across the plotting table. The chaos was only apparent, Robert realized, as he watched the small dark man work, for Prathachulthorn never needed to search for anything. Whatever it was he wanted, somehow he found it with barely a flick of his shadowed eyes and a quick grasp of his calloused hands. At intervals, the Marine officer glanced over to a holotank and muttered subvocally into his throat microphone. Data whirled in the tank, shifting and turning in subtle rearrangements at his command. Robert waited, standing at ease in front of the table of rough-cut logs. It was the fourth time Prathachulthorn had summoned him to answer tersely phrased questions. Each time Robert grew more awed by the man's obvious precision and skill. Clearly, Major Prathachulthorn was a professional. In only a day, he and his small staff had started to bring order to the partisan's makeshift tactical programs, rearranging data, sifting out patterns and insights the amateur insurgents had never even imagined. Prathachulthorn was everything their movement had needed. He was exactly what they had been praying for. No question about it. Robert hated the man's guts. Now he was trying to figure out exactly why. I mean, besides the fact that he's making me stand here in silence until he's good and ready. Robert recognized that for a simple way of reinforcing the message of who was boss. Knowing that helped him take it with good grace. Mostly. The Major looked every inch the complete Terrigan's commando, even though his sole military adornment was an insignia of rank at his left shoulder. Not even in full dress uniform would Robert ever look as much a soldier as Prathachulthorn did right now, draped in ill-fitting cloth woven by gorillas under a sulphurous volcano. The Earthman spent some time drumming his fingers on the table. The repetitious thumping reminded Robert of the headache he'd been trying to fight off with biofeedback for an hour or more. For some reason, the technique wasn't working this time. He felt closed in, claustrophobic, short of breath, and seemed to be getting worse. At last, Prathachulthorn looked up. To Robert's surprise, the man's first remark could be taken as something distantly akin to a compliment.
"Well, Captain Oneagle," Prathachulthorn said, "I confess to having feared things would be much, much worse than I find them here."
"I'm relieved to hear it, sir." Prathachulthorn's eyes narrowed, as if he suspected an ever so thin veneer of sarcasm in Robert's voice.
"To be precise," he went on, "I feared I would discover that you had lied in your report to the Council in Exile, and that I would have to shoot you."
Robert suppressed an impulse to swallow and managed to maintain an impassive expression.
"I'm glad that did not turn out to be necessary, sir."
"So am I. I'm sure your mother would have been irritated, for one thing.
As it is, and bearing in mind that yours was a strictly amateur enterprise, I'm willing to credit you with a good effort here."
Major Prathachulthorn shook his head.
"No, that's unfairly restrained. Let me put it this way. There is much I'd have done otherwise had I been here, but in light of how poorly the official forces have fared, you and your chims have performed very well indeed."
Robert felt a hollowness in his chest begin to relax.
"I'm sure the Chims will be glad to hear it, sir. I'd like to point out, though, that I was not sole leader here. The Timbrimi Athaclena carried a good part of that burden."
Major Prathachulthorn's expression turned sour. Robert wasn't sure if it was because Athaclena was a galactic, or because Robert, as a militia officer, should have retained all authority himself.
"Ah, yes, the General."
His indulgent smile was patronizing at the very least. He nodded.
"I will mention her assistance in my report, Ambassador Uther Kalving's daughter is clearly a resourceful young alien. I hope she is willing to continue helping us in some capacity. The Chims worship her, sir, Robert pointed out. Major Prophet Chulthorn nodded. As he looked toward the wall, his voice took on a thoughtful tone. The Timbrimi mystique, I know. Sometimes I wonder if the media knows what the hell it's doing, creating such ideas. Allies or no allies, our people have got to understand that Earth Clan will always be fundamentally alone. We'll never be able to fully trust anything galactic. Then, as if he might have said too much, Pratha Chulthorn shook his head and changed the subject. Now, about future operations against the enemy.
We've been thinking about that, sir. Their mysterious surge of activity in the mountains seems to have ended, though for how long we don't know. Still, there are some ideas we've been batting around, things we might use against them when and if they come back.
Good, Pratha Chulthorn nodded. But you must understand that in the future we'll have to coordinate all actions in the Mulan with other planetary forces. Irregulars are simply incapable of hurting the enemy where his real assets are. That was demonstrated when the City Chim insurrectionists were wiped out, trying to attack the space batteries near Port Helenia. Robert saw Pratha Chulthorn's point.
Yes, sir. Although since then we have captured some munitions which could be useful.
A few missiles, yes. They might be handy if we can figure out how to use them. And especially if we have the right information about where to point them.
We have altogether too little data, the Major went on.
I want to gather more and report back to the Council. After that, our task will be to prepare to support any action they choose to undertake. Robert finally asked the question that he had put off since returning to find Pratha Chulthorn and his small group of human officers here, turning the cave refuge upside down, poking into everything, taking over.
What will be done with our organization, sir?
Atha, Klena, and I, we've given a number of Chims working officer status, but except for me, nobody here has a real colonial commission.
Pratha Chulthorn pursed his lips. Well, you're the simplest case, Captain. Clearly you deserve a rest. You can escort Ambassador Uther Kalving's daughter back to the refuge with our next report, along with my recommendation for a promotion and a medal. I know the coordinator would like that. You can fill them in on how you made your fine discovery about the Gubru residence tracking technique. From his tone of voice, the Major made it quite clear what he would think of Robert if he took up the offer.
On the other hand, I'd be pleased to have you join my staff with a brevet marine status of first lieutenant, in addition to your colonial commission. We could use your experience.
Thank you, sir. I think I'll remain here, if that's all right with you.
Fine. Then we'll assign someone else to escort.
I'm sure Atha Klena will want to stay as well.
Robert hurriedly added.
Well, yes. I am certain she could be helpful for a while. Tell you what, Captain. I'll put the matter to the Council in my next letter. But we must be sure of one thing. Her status is no longer military. The Chims are to cease referring to her as a command officer. Is that clear?
Yes, sir. Quite clear.
Robert only wondered how one enforced that sort of order on civilian neo-chimpanzees, who tended to call anybody and anything whatever they pleased.
Good. Now, as for those formerly under your command, I do happen to have brought with me a few blank colonial commissions, which we can assign to Chims who have shown notable initiative. I have no doubt you'll recommend names.
Robert nodded.
I will, sir.
He recalled that one other member of their army, besides himself, had already been in the militia. The thought of Fibbon, certainly dead for a long time now, made him suddenly even more depressed.
These caves, they're driving me nuts. It's getting harder and harder to bear the time I must spend down here.
Major Pratha Chulthorn was a disciplined soldier and had spent months in the council's underground refuge, but Robert had no such firmness of character.
"I've got to get out."
"Sir," he said quickly, "I'd like to ask your permission to leave base camp for a few days to run an errand down near Lorne Pass at the ruins of the Hallett Center."
Pratha Chulthorn frowned. "The place where those guerrillas were illegally gene-meddled?"
"The place where we won our first victory," he reminded the commando, "and where we made the Gubru accept parole."
"Huh," the major grunted. "What do you expect to find there?"
Robert suppressed an impulse to shrug. In his suddenly worsening claustrophobia, in his need for any excuse to get away, he pulled forth an idea that had until then only been a glimmer at the back of his mind.
"A possible weapon, sir. It's a concept for something that might help a lot if it worked."
That piqued Pratha Chulthorn's interest.
"What is this weapon?"
"I'd rather not be specific right now, sir, not until I've had a chance to verify a few things. I'll only be gone 3 or 4 days at the most, I promise."
"Hmm. Well," Pratha Chulthorn's lips pursed, "it will take that long just to put these data systems into shape. You'll only get underfoot till that's done. Afterwards, though, I'll be needing you. We've got to prepare a report to the council."
"Yes, sir. I'll hurry back."
"Very well, then. Take Lieutenant McHugh with you. I want one of my own men to see the countryside. Show McHugh how you accomplished your little coup. Introduce her to the leaders of the more important Chim partisan bands in that area. Then return without delay. Dismissed."
Robert came to attention.
"I think I know now why I hate him," Robert realized as he saluted, performed an about-face, and walked out through the hanging blanket that served as a door to the subterranean office.
Ever since he had returned to the caves to find Pratha Chulthorn and his aides moving around like owners, patronizing the Chims and judging everything they had all done together, Robert had been unable to stop feeling like a child who had, until that moment, been allowed to play a wonderful dramatic role, a really fun game. But now the child had to bear paternal pats on the head, strokes that burned, even if intended in praise. It was an embarrassing analogy, and yet he knew that in a sense it was true after all. Robert blew a silent sigh and hurried away from the office and dark armory he had shared with Athaklana, but which now had been completely taken over by grown-ups. Only when he was finally back under the tall forest canopy did Robert feel he could breathe freely again. The tree's familiar scents seemed to cleanse his lungs of the dank cave odors. The scouts who flitted ahead of him and alongside were those he knew, quick, loyal, feral-looking with their crossbows and sooty faces.
"My Chims," he thought, feeling a little guilty that it came to him in those words. But the feeling of proprietorship was there anyway. It was like the old days, before yesterday, when he had felt important and needed.
The illusion broke apart, though, the next time Lieutenant McHugh spoke.
"These mountain forests are very beautiful," she said. "I wish I'd taken the time to come up here before the war broke out."
The Earthling officer stopped by the side of the trail to touch a blue-veined flower, but it folded away from her fingers and retreated backward into the thicket.
"I've read about these things, but this is my first chance to see them for myself."
Robert grunted noncommittally. He would be polite and answer any direct question, but he wasn't interested in conversation, especially with Major Pratha Chulthorn's second-in-command. Lydia McHugh was an athletic young woman with dark, well-cut features. Her movements, lithe like a commando's or an assassin's, were by that same nature also quite graceful.
dressed in homespun, kilt, and blouse, she might have been taken for a peasant dancer if it weren't for the self-winding arbalest she cradled in the crook of one arm like a child. In hip pouches were enough darts to pincushion half the goo-brew within 100 kilometers. The knives sheathed at her wrists and ankles were for more than show. She seemed to have very little trouble keeping up with his rapid pace through the criss-cross jungle mesh of vines. That was just as well, for he wasn't about to slow down. At the back of his mind, Robert knew he was being unfair. She was probably a nice enough person in her own way, for a professional soldier. But for some reason, everything likable about her seemed to irritate him all the more. Robert wished Athaclena had consented to come along. But she had insisted on remaining in her glade near the caves, experimenting with tame vines and crafting strange, ornate glyphs that were far too subtle to be kenned by his own weak powers. Robert had felt hurt and stormed off, almost outracing his escorts for the first few kilometers.
"So much life!" The Earthwoman kept pace beside him and inhaled the rich odors. "This is a peaceful place."
"You're wrong on both counts," Robert thought, with a trace of contempt for her dull human insensitivity to the truth about Garth, a truth he could feel all around him. Through Athaclena's tutoring, he now could reach out, albeit tentatively, awkwardly, and trace the life waves that fluxed through the quiet forest.
"This is an unhappy land," he replied simply. He did not elaborate, even when she gave him a puzzled look. His primitive empathy sense withdrew from her confusion. For a while they moved in silence. The morning aged. Once the scouts whistled, and they took cover under thick branches as great cruisers lumbered overhead. When the way was clear, Robert took to the trail again without a word. At last, Lydia McHugh spoke again.
"This place we're heading for," she asked. "This Howlett Center, would you please tell me about it?"
It was a simple request. He could not refuse, since Pretha Chilthorn had sent her along to be shown things. But Robert avoided her black eyes as he spoke. He tried to be matter-of-fact, but emotion kept creeping into his voice. Under her low prompting, Robert told Lydia McHugh about the sad, misguided, but brilliant work of the renegade scientists. His mother had known nothing of the Howlett Center, of course. It was only by accident that he himself had learned of it a year or so before the invasion, and he had decided to keep silent. Of course, the daring experiment was over now. It would take more than a miracle to save the neo-gorillas from sterilization, now that the secret was known to people like Major Pratha Chilthorn. Pratha Chilthorn might hate galactic civilization with a passion that bordered on fanaticism, but he knew how essential it was that Terrans not break their solemn pacts with the great institutes. Right now, Earth's only hope lay in the ancient codes of the progenitors. To keep the protection of those codes, weak clans had to be like Caesar's wife, above reproach. Lydia McHugh listened attentively. She had high cheekbones and eyes that were sultry in their darkness. It pained Robert to look at them, though. Those eyes seemed somehow to be set too close together, too immobile. He kept his attention on the crooked path ahead of him. And yet, with a soft voice, the young Marine officer drew him out. Robert found himself talking about Phib and Bulger, about their narrow escape together from the gas bombing of the Mendoza Freehold, and of his friend's first journey down into the Sindh, and the second, from which he never returned. They crested a ridge topped with eerie spine stones and came to an opening overlooking a narrow vale just west of Lorne Pass. He gestured to the tumbled outlines of several burned structures.
"The Howlett Center," he said flatly.
"This is where you forced the Gubru to acknowledge Chim combatants, isn't it?"
and made them give parole?
Lydia McHugh asked. Robert realized he was hearing respect in her voice, and turned briefly to stare at her. She returned his look with a smile. Robert felt his face grow warm. He swung back quickly, pointing to the hillside nearest the center, and rapidly describing how the trap had been laid and sprung, skipping only his own trapeze leap to take out the Gubru's entry. His part had been unimportant anyway. The Chims were the crucial ones that morning. He wanted the Earthling soldiers to know that. He was finishing his story when Elsie approached. The Chimmies saluted him, something that had never seemed necessary before the Marines arrived.
"I don't know about actually going down there, sir," she said earnestly. "The enemy's already shown an interest in those ruins. They may have come back."
Robert shook his head. When Benjamin paroled the enemy survivors, one condition they accepted was to stay out of this valley and not even keep its approaches under surveillance from then on. Has there been any sign of them breaking their word? Elsie shook her head.
No, but...
Her lips pressed together, as if she felt she ought to forbear comment on the wisdom of trusting the pledges of E.T.'s. Robert smiled.
Well, then, come on. If we hurry, we can be in and back out by nightfall.
Elsie shrugged. She had made a quick set of hand gestures. Several Chims darted out of the spine stones and down into the forest. After a moment, there came an all-clear whistle. The rest of the party crossed the gap at a brisk run.
"They are very good," Lydia McHugh told him softly, after they were back under the trees again.
Robert nodded, recognizing that she had not qualified her remark by adding, "for amateurs," as Protha Chilthorn would have done. He was grateful for that, and wished she wasn't being so nice. Soon they were picking their way toward tumbled ruins, carefully searching for signs that anyone else had been there since the battle, months ago. There did not seem to be any, but that did not diminish the intense vigilance of the Chims. Robert tried to ken, to use the net to probe for intruders, but his own jumbled feelings kept getting in the way. He wished Athaclena were here. The wreckage of the Howlett Center was even more complete than had been apparent from the hillside. The fire-blackened buildings had collapsed further under wild jungle vegetation, now growing rampant over former lawns. The Gubru vehicles, long ago stripped of anything useful, lay in tangles of thick grass as tall as his waist.
"No, clearly nobody's been here," he thought.
Robert kicked through the wreckage. Nothing remained of interest.
"Why did I insist on coming?" he wondered.
He knew his hunch, whether it panned out or not, had actually been little more than an excuse to escape from the caves, to get away from Protha Chilthorn, to get away from uncomfortable glimpses of himself. Perhaps one reason he had chosen to come to this place was because it was here that he had had his own brief moment of hand-to-hand contact with the enemy. Or maybe he had hoped to recreate the feelings of only a few days ago, traveling unfettered and unjudged. He had hoped to come here with different female company than the woman who now followed him, eyes darting left and right, putting everything under professional scrutiny. Robert turned away from his brooding thoughts and walked toward the ruined alien hover tanks. He sank to one knee, brushing aside the tall, rank grass. Gubru machinery, the exposed guts of the armored vehicles, gears, impellers, gravitics, a fine yellow patina overlay many of the parts. In some places, the shining plastimesh had discolored, thinned, and even broken through. Robert pulled on a small chunk, which came off, crumbling in his hands.
"Well, I'll be a blue-nosed gopher. I was right. My hunch was right."
"What is it?" Lieutenant McHugh asked over his shoulder. He shook his head.
"I'm not sure yet. but something seems to be eating through a lot of these parts. May I see?
Robert handed her the piece of corroded cerament.
This is why you wanted to come here? You suspected this?
He saw no point in telling her all the complex reasons, the personal ones.
That was a large part of it. I thought maybe there might be a weapon in it. They burned all the records and facilities when they evacuated the center, but they couldn't eradicate all the microbes developed in Dr. Schultz's lab.
He didn't add that he had a vial of gorilla saliva in his pack. If he had not found the Gubru armor in this state, on arriving here, he had planned to perform his own experiments.
Hmm.
Lydia McHugh crumbled the material in her hand. She got down and crawled under the machine to examine which parts had been affected. Finally, she emerged and sat next to Robert.
It could prove useful, but there would still be the problem of a delivery system. We don't dare venture out of the mountains to spray the little bugs over Gubru equipment in Port Helena. Also, biosabotage weapons are very short-term in their effectiveness. They have to be used all at once, and by surprise, since countermeasures are usually swift and effective. After a few weeks, the bugs would be neutralized, chemically with coatings or by cloning another beastie to eat ours. Still,
she turned another piece over and looked up to smile at Robert.
This is great. What you did here before and now this, these are the right ways to fight guerrilla war. I like it. We'll find a way to use it.
Her smile was so open and friendly that Robert couldn't help responding. And in that shared moment, he felt a stirring that he had been trying to suppress all day.
Damn, she's attractive,
he realized miserably. His body was sending him signals more powerful than it ever had in the company of Athaclena, and he barely knew this woman. He didn't love her. He wasn't bound up with her as he was with his Timbrimi consort. And yet his mouth was dry, and his heart beat faster as she looked at him, this narrow-eyed, thin-nosed, tall-browed female human.
We better be heading home, he said quickly. Go ahead and take some samples, Lieutenant. We'll test them back at base.
He ignored her long look as he stood up and signaled to Elsie. Soon, with specimens stowed away in their packs, they were climbing once more toward the spine stones. The watchful guards showed obvious relief as they shouldered their rifles and leaped back into the trees. Robert followed his escort with little attention to the path. He was trying not to think of the other member of his own race walking beside him. So he frowned and kept himself banked in behind a brumous cloud of his own thoughts. Chapter 59 Fibbon. Fibbon and Galet sat near each other under the unblinking regard of masked Gubru technicians, who focused their instruments on the two chims with dispassionate, clinical precision. Multi-lensed globes and flat-plate phased arrays floated on all sides, peering down at them. The testing chamber was a jungle of glistening tubes and shiny-faced machinery, all antiseptic and sterile. Still, the place reeked of alien bird. Fibbon's nose wrinkled, and once again he disciplined himself to avoid thinking unfriendly thoughts about the Gubru. Certainly several of the imposing machines must be psi detectors, and while it was doubtful they could actually read his mind, the Galactics certainly would be able to trace his surface attitudes. Fibbon reached for something else to think about. He leaned to his left and spoke to Galet.
I talked to Sylvie before they came for us this morning. She told me she hasn't been back to the Apes' Grape since that night I first came to Port Helena.
Galet turned to look at Fibbon. Her expression was tense, disapproving.
So? Games like that striptease of hers may be obsolete now, but I'm sure the Gubru are finding other ways to use her unique talents.
She's refused to do anything like that since then, Galen.
Honestly, I can't see why you're so hostile toward her.
And I find it hard to understand how you can be so friendly with one of our jailers,
Galen snapped.
She's a probationer and a collaborator.
Thibin shook his head.
Actually, Sylvie's not really a Proby at all, nor even a gray or yellow. She has a green repro card. She joined them because...
I don't give a damn what her reasons were.
Oh, I can imagine what sort of sob story she's told you, you big dope, while she batted her eyelashes and softened you up for...
From one of the nearby machines came a low atonal voice.
Young neo-chimpanzee softens. Be still. Be still, young clients.
It soothed. Galet swiveled a face forward, her jaw set. Thibin blinked.
I wish I understood her better, he thought.
Half the time, he had no idea what would set Galet off.
It was Galet's moodiness that had started him talking with Sylvie in the first place, simply for company. He wanted to explain that to Galet, but decided it would do no good. Better to wait. She would come out of this funk, she always did. Only an hour ago, they had been laughing, jostling each other while they fumbled with a complicated mechanical puzzle. For a few minutes they had been able to forget the staring mechanical and alien eyes while they worked as a team, sorting and resorting the pieces and arranging them together. When they stood back at last and looked on the completed tower they had made, they both knew that they had surprised the note-takers. In that moment of satisfaction, Galet's hand had slipped, innocently and affectionately, into his. Imprisonment was like that. Part of the time, Thibin actually felt as if he were profiting from the experience. It was the first time in his life, for instance, that he'd ever really had time to just sit and think. Their captors now let them have books, and he was catching up on quite a few volumes he'd always wanted to read. Conversations with Galet had opened up the arcane world of alienology. He, in turn, had spoken to her of the great work being done here on Garth, delicately nudging a ruined ecosystem back toward health. But then all too common had been the long, darker intervals, when the hours dragged on and on. A pall hung over them at such times. The walls seemed to close in, and conversation always came back to the war, to memories of their failed insurrection, to lost friends and gloomy speculations over the fate of Earth itself. At such times, Thibin thought he might trade all hope of a long life for just an hour to run free under trees and clean sky. So even this new routine of testing by the Gubru had come as a relief for both of them. At least it was a distraction. Without warning, the machine suddenly pulled away, opening an avenue in front of their bench.
"We are finished. Finished. You have done well. Done well. You have... Now, follow the globe. Follow it toward transportation."
As Thibin and Galet stood up, a brown octahedral projection took form in front of them. Without looking at each other, they followed the hologram past the silent, brooding avian technicians, out of the testing chamber, and down a long hallway. Surface robots swept past them with the soft whisper of well-tuned machinery. Once a Kwaku technician darted out of an office door, favored them with a startled look, then ducked back inside. At last, Thibin and Galet passed through a hissing portal and emerged into bright sunshine. Thibin had to shade his eyes. The day was fair, but with a bite that seemed to say that brief summer was now well on its way out. The chims he could see in the streets, beyond the Gubru compound, were wearing light sweaters and sneakers, another sure sign that autumn was near. None of the chims looked their way. The distance was too great for Thibin to tell anything of their mood or to hope
that somebody might recognize him or Galen.
"We won't be riding the same car back," whispered Galen,
and she motioned down a long parapet toward the landing ramp below. Sure enough, the tan military van that had brought them had been replaced by a large, roofless hover barge. An ornate pedestal stood in the open deck behind the pilot station. Quacku's servitors adjusted a sunshade to keep the fierce light of Gimel-High off their master's beak and crest. The large Gubru was recognizable. Its thick, faintly luminous plumage looked shaggier than the last time they had seen it, in the furtive darkness of their suburban prison. The effect was to make it seem even more different than the run-of-the-mill Gubru functionaries they had seen. In some places, the Alacruis feathers had begun to appear frayed, tattered. The avian aristocrat wore a striped collar. It paced impatiently atop its perch.
"Well, well," Thibbin muttered, "if it ain't our old friend, the something of good housekeeping."
Galet snorted in something just short of a small laugh.
"It's called the suzerain of propriety," she reminded him. "The striped torque means it's the leader of the priestly caste. Now just you remember to behave yourself. Try not to scratch too much and watch what I do."
"I'll imitate your very steps precisely, mistress."
Galet ignored his sarcasm and followed the brown guidance hologram down the long ramp toward the brightly colored barge. Bibbin kept pace just a little behind her. The guide projection vanished as they reached the landing. A Quacku, with its feathery ruff tinted a garish shade of pink, offered them both a very shallow bow.
"You are honored, honored, that our patron, noble patron, does deign to show you, you half-formed ones, the favor of your destiny."
The Quacku spoke without the assistance of a vodor. That in itself was no small miracle, given the creature's highly specialized speech organs. In fact, it spoke the Anglic words fairly clearly, if with a breathless quality which made the alien sound nervous, expectant. It wasn't likely the suzerain of propriety was the easiest boss in the universe to work for. Fibbin imitated Galet's bow and kept silent as she replied,
"We are honored by the attention that your master, the high patron of a great clan, condescends to offer us,"
she said in slow, carefully enunciated Galactic Seven.
"Nevertheless, we retain, in our own patron's names, the right to disapprove its actions."
Even Fibbin gasped. The assembled Quacku cooed in anger, fluffing up threateningly. Three high, chirped notes cut their outrage off abruptly. The lead Quacku swiveled quickly and bowed to the suzerain, who had scuttled to the end of its perch closest to the two chims. The Gubru's beak gaped as it bent to regard Galet, first with one eye, then the other. Fibbin found himself sweating rivulets. Finally, the alien straightened and squawked a pronouncement in its own highly clipped, inflected version of Galactic Three. Only Fibbin saw the tremor of relief that passed down Galet's tense spine. He could not follow the suzerain's stilted prose, but a vodor nearby commenced translating promptly.
"Well said. Said well. Spoken well for captured client-class soldiers of foe clan Terra. Come, then, come and see. Come and see and hear a bargain you will certainly not disapprove, not even in your patron's names."
Galet and Fibbin glanced at each other. Then, as one, they bowed. The late morning air was clear, and the faint ozone smell probably did not foretell rain. Such ancient cues were useless in the presence of high technology anyway.
the barge cruised south past the closed pleasure piers of Port Helena and out across the bay. It was Fibbon's first chance to see how the harbor had changed since the aliens had arrived. The fishing fleet had been crippled, for one thing. Only one in four trawlers did not lie beached or in dry dock. The main commercial port was almost dead as well. A clump of dispirited-looking seafaring vessels listed at their moorings, clearly untouched for months. Fibbon watched one of the still-working fishing trawlers heave into view around the point of the bay, probably returning early with a fortuitous catch. Or with a mechanical failure, the Chim crew felt unable to deal with at sea. The tub-bottom boat rose and fell as it rode the standing swell where sea met bay. The crew had to struggle since the passage was narrower than it had been in days of peace. Half of the strait was now blocked by a towering, curving cliff face, a great fortress of alien serimetal. The Gubru battleship seemed to shimmer in a faint haze. Water droplets condensed at the fringes of its ward screens. Rainbows sparkled and a mist fell over the struggling trawler as it forced its way past the northern tongue of land at last. Fibbon could not make out the faces of the Chim crew as the suzerain's barge swept overhead. But he saw several long-armed forms slump in relief as the boat reached calm waters at last. From Point Borealis, the upper arm of the bay shore swept several kilometers north and east toward Port Helena itself. Except for a small navigation beacon, those rough heights were unoccupied. The branches of ridgetop pines riffled gently in the sea breezes. Southward, however, across the narrow strait, things were quite different. Beyond the grounded battleship, the terrain had been transformed. Forest growth had been removed, the contours of the bluffs altered. Dust rose from a site just out of view beyond the headland. A swarm of hovers and heavy lifters could be seen buzzing to and fro in that direction. Much farther to the south, toward the spaceport, new domes had been erected as part of the Gubru defensive network. The facilities the urban guerrillas had only mildly inconvenienced in their abortive insurrection. But the barge did not seem to be heading that way. Rather, they turned toward the new construction on the narrow, hilly slopes between Aspinall Bay and the Sea of Silmar. Fibbon knew it was hopeless asking their hosts what was going on. The Kwaku technicians and servitors were polite, but it was a severe sort of courtesy, probably on orders, and they were not forthcoming with much information. Galet joined him at the railing and took his elbow. "Look," she whispered in a hushed voice. Together they stared as the barge rose over the bluffs. A hilltop had been shorn flat near the ocean shoreline. Buildings Fibbon recognized as proton power plants lay clustered around its base, feeding cables upward along its flanks. At the top, a hemispherical structure lay face upward, glimmering and open like a marble bowl in the sunshine.
"What is it? A force field projector? Some kind of weapon?"
Fibbon nodded, shook his head, and finally shrugged.
"Beats me. It doesn't look military. Whatever it does sure must take a lot of juice. Look at all those power plants. Good all."
A shadow slipped over them, not with the fluffy, ragged coolness of a cloud passing before the sun, but with the sudden, sharp chill of something solid and huge rumbling over their heads. Fibbon shivered only partly from the drop in temperature. He and Galet couldn't help crouching as they looked up at the giant lifter carrier that cruised only 100 meters higher. Their avian hosts, on the other hand, appeared unruffled. The suzerain stood on its perch, placidly ignoring the thrumming fields that made the Chims tremble.